Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science with me, Sean Duke, live from the studios of 103.2 Dublin City FM here in the centre of Dublin City. Today's programme has a decidedly geological theme, with geology of course being the study of rocks. In What's It All About today, the subject is seafloor spreading, a phenomenon that created Iceland. And we'll be talking to Betty Higgs of the UCC Geology Department in our What's It All About slot there. Now, tectonic plates, these are the massive pieces of the Earth's crust that collide to create earthquakes and volcanoes. But are they less rigid than we previously thought? We'll be putting this question to Sergei Lebedev of the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, who's just published a paper in Nature Geoscience on this particular question. And in Writer's Room today, I'll be talking to Patrick Wise Jackson. He's the author of a new book called Introducing Paleontology, A Guide to Ancient Life. That's all about fossils. And he's the curator of the Geological Museum at Trinity College in Dublin. But first up today, we're talking about this phenomenon of seafloor spreading. And I'm delighted to welcome Betty Higgs, researcher in geology at UCC, to the show. Hi, Betty.
Hello, Sean.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Some people may not realise that something called seafloor spreading exists. So maybe we should try and, point out where it exists in the world and what exactly is it?
Okay. Well, most people have seen recently the phenomena that occurs in Iceland, where we have volcanic activity.
Sure.
And they may be wondering, or they may have some understanding of why it's happening. Now, Iceland is really just one little place in the Earth where we can see a process that's occurring in many places in the Earth.
Now, I've been to Iceland, sorry to cut across you, but you can actually see in the centre of Iceland, you can go out and look at a kind of a ridge or a gap where literally the Earth seems to be pulled apart. And, literally one piece is going one direction, one piece is going the other direction. So is this seafloor spreading or something similar?
Yes.
Even though it's not on the seafloor?
Yes. Well, you're right. We're at the boundary between two plates. So two plates, the plate is approximately, well, it could be between, say, 50 and 100 kilometres thick. But in Iceland, it's a little bit thinner. But the plates are moving apart. So on one side of Iceland, the plate is moving towards Europe, I suppose, and the other side of Iceland, it's moving to the west. And in the gap, and in the pull-apart gap, new molten rock rises from the Earth's mantle.
Okay, so it's been pulled apart, and this magma or mantle, as you call it, this molten rock is coming up from underneath, and it's creating new rock at the surface. So suppose people might have a question, well, what's causing this? What's causing these two big chunks of the Earth's crust to be moving in opposite directions?
Yes, well, you have to envisage this as part of a mountain ridge, if you like, that goes all the way down the middle of the North and South Atlantic. And usually the volcanic activity is about 2.5 kilometres under the seafloor, so we don't see any expression of it. We might feel a little few earthquakes if we have a seismometer measuring equipment. But this is quite quiet volcanic activity, and it's producing new oceanic crust.
Okay.
And we just happen to be able to go and investigate this phenomena very easily in Iceland because it has risen above.
It's on the surface. And of course, this would explain why the rocks are very new in Iceland, aren't they? Because they're constantly having these eruptions.
Yes. So down either side of this volcanic activity, the rocks are the youngest oceanic crust in the world. And that's the same all the way down the middle of the Atlantic. And we might refer to Iceland as a sort of ocean crust factory. That's where it's being produced.
Okay, so can I just say, so we have this process whereby new rock, molten rock, is coming up through a crack and, it's being laid down. So if rock is being created, why isn't the Earth expanding, if you like, and getting bigger all the time?
Yes, that's a good question. And what happens is very often, because this process occurs in many of the oceans, it's not just the Atlantic, what happens is new oceanic crust is formed, and we can look at what happens to it while it exists. But then there are other parts of the Earth where the oceanic crust is destroyed. And most of us would know those areas as volcanically active areas. such as around the Philippines, around Japan, around the Caribbean. Anywhere where we're getting explosive volcanic activity, we're probably getting destruction of oceanic crust nearby.
So is this where you have, from a bit of reading I've done, yes, you have a piece of crust that literally plunges back into the, yes, towards the core of the Earth, and it melts. So you have this happening, which is creating volcanoes on the surface. So crust is being destroyed in one part of the world and is, yes, being created in, yes, another part of the world.
Yes. So that has implications for the age of the crust. Mm-hmm. There is a maximum age on the crust. It doesn't go back as far as the age of the continental crust because it's being destroyed. The oldest oceanic crust is about 180 million years old.
Okay, and the Earth, the oldest rocks that we know of on the Earth would be what?
Would be about 20 times that. So
okay, so they're all quite new.
4 billion years, mm-hmm, old for the continental rocks, which don't get destroyed. They're very buoyant. They don't sink back down into the mantle and become destroyed.
Where are the main ridges then, where this seafloor spreading happens? There's a big ridge through, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge we've spoken of.
The Mid-Atlantic Ridge.
Where else does it happen in the world?
It's actually a continuous ridge for about almost 60,000 kilometres around the Earth. So it goes round just north of Antarctica. It comes up into the Indian Ocean. And we have the ridge going up, not quite up the middle of the Pacific. It's off to the east, so it's a little bit nearer to California than it is to Japan. But we have an oceanic ridge in the Pacific too. So the Pacific crust is also being generated at that ridge.
Okay, so Iceland is quite unusual because it's one of the few places, then, by the sound of it, where you can actually see,
yes,
this happening on land.
Yes, and it's because two phenomena come together there. There's the mid-ocean ridge processes, which are produced because heat is escaping from the Earth along these mid-ocean ridges. But we also have something we call a mantle plume, which is just an extra hot area under the lithosphere that produces more volcanic material than usual.
Okay.
So it builds up a massive amount of volcanic material in Iceland.
Okay, and just a final question. Do we fully understand seafloor spreading, or is there anything, any new research is going on to try and understand it better?
Yes. Well, I suppose it would be very dangerous to say we fully understand anything, so I won't say that. We have a really good understanding compared to when it was first named in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
We've come a long way, and it sent all of the scientists, all of the geoscientists, off looking at their own data to see how it fits in with the seafloor spreading idea. And we do. We have people researching where they're going down in submersibles now and gathering samples and getting to know more and more about the detail of how the plates can move and how they fracture and the stresses within them. And it's bringing new, smaller insights, but important insights to bear on the story. But it hasn't changed the fundamental story that the seafloor is spreading away from these ridges.
And it's a dynamic Earth, obviously, that
it's
everything
a dynamic
is changing.
Earth. Nothing stays the same. This ocean floor is growing at things rates like 2 centimetres per year. So here in Ireland, we're getting further away from America every year.
A couple of inches a year, is it?
Maybe, yeah, or 2 or 3 centimetres a year.
Okay.
But it's a dynamic Earth and things keep changing.
Okay, Betty. Listen, thanks very much for coming on and telling us about seafloor spreading. It's a very interesting geological phenomenon. That's Betty Higgs. She's a researcher, geology researcher based at University College in Cork. Thanks, Betty.
Bye-bye.
Now, just to move on, this in a regular slot I've started where it's called Did You See? I'm going to take just a piece of news from the world of science each week, and this week it caught my eye, a study. We've always thought that testosterone, of course, can make people more aggressive. That's the male hormone. Now is being supported by research that's been done at Cambridge University and Utrecht University, which is in Holland. And basically what they found is they gave 16 women, young women, of course women don't have as much testosterone as men, so this is why they were given the testosterone. They tested them, they gave them increased levels of the male hormone testosterone just to see if they were better or worse at empathy. Empathy, of course, being the ability to infer what a person is thinking or feeling from photographs of facial expressions, whether somebody is angry or sad or happy. Traditionally, women have been more associated with these skills than men. And interestingly, there was a significant reduction in their ability to read other people's facial features from increased levels of testosterone, which, of course, may go some way to explaining also why there's more male autism cases. That's, you know, almost 75% or more of cases of autism are in men. Maybe this is a link with testosterone, because with autism, of course, the boys and men with autism have trouble communicating and are not very empathetic towards their fellow human beings, in the sense that they can't read the social signals too well. So that's an interesting study that was published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. But we're going to move on now, and we're going to talk again about tectonic plates. We were talking a little bit about tectonic plates there with our previous guest. But now we're going to talk about whether these huge pieces of the Earth's crust that can collide and grind past each other and go underneath and over each other and create earthquakes and volcanoes, well, are they less rigid than we previously thought? Well, to discuss this, I'm delighted to have on the line Sergei Lebedev. He's based at the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, and he's published a paper on this in the prestigious journal Nature Geosciences. So welcome to the programme, Sergei.
Thank you, Sam.
Yeah, so congratulations on your paper, first of all, a prestigious magazine or journal, I should say, Nature Geosciences. But this this is something very new, because obviously geologists, correct me if I'm wrong, they thought that these pieces of the Earth's crust were very rigid and hard and they grinded past each other. But now it seems that they might be a little bit less rigid than we previously thought.
Well, yes, plate tectonics explains most motions on the Earth's surface in terms of rigid tectonic plates, and that works very well for about 85% of the Earth. But the remaining 15% includes all the geologically active parts of continents, so this is where interesting things happen. And in these parts, the lithosphere deforms, and we don't quite know how it does so. It has been, in fact, one of the biggest unsolved problems in geology for some decades.
Now, when you say the active areas, you mean the areas really where there are, say, volcanoes or a lot of earthquake activity?
Well, in Europe, for example, the most active area is the Aegean region, Greece and Turkey.
Where's that? Greece and Turkey, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, that's where we have most earthquakes in Europe, some dangerous volcanoes like Santorini. And this is where the plates are not rigid. They deform, but we do not know quite how they do so.
So just to give an overview, what's actually happening in these areas to create these earthquakes? You know, there's pieces of crust coming together, yeah?
Well, it's a very complicated area. The Mediterranean, in general, is where Africa is converging and colliding with Europe. So in a few tens of millions of years, it's likely there will be no more Mediterranean, but there will be a new supercontinent comprising Europe and Africa.
So the Mediterranean then is getting smaller, a little bit smaller all the time.
Oh, yes, it does.
Okay, right. Sorry, go ahead.
But it is a complicated process, and the part of African plate goes down, sinking deep into the earth beneath Greece and Turkey. And as it does so, gravity forces it to retreat, roll back. And this is what stretches the Aegean Sea. And this is why it has been stretched by as much as 600 kilometers over the past 50 million years.
Mm-hmm.
And this stretching drives all these complicated deformation processes, and this causes earthquakes and the deformation of the plates that we have studied.
Okay, now obviously if you published in this journal, you found something that was very important. So what was really of interest from a scientific point of view in your observations, and how did you do those measurements?
Well, if you look at the surface in the Aegean region, you see relatively small blocks of crust that are relatively rigid, and they slide past each other along faults as they move past each other. That causes earthquakes. And most geologists have believed that this is how the plates behave throughout the entire thickness, by in terms of blocks sliding past each other. Now, we have discovered that the strongest, densest, deep part of the plate is in fact flowing like a viscous fluid. And it is important because this deep part of the plate is the strongest, so this deep part determines how the plate behaves, how it moves, so eventually it determines deformation as well as earthquake, the surface impression, expressions of it.
So when things get really, when it's really under an awful lot of pressure, the rock, the crust, it actually starts to change and become more like a fluid than a solid?
Well, this has to do more with temperature. Mm. The crust at the surface, it's very cold at ambient temperature, but as we go down, the temperature goes up quickly, and this is why the strongest part of the plate, a few tens of kilometers down, 30, 50 kilometers, it is in fact a very, very viscous fluid that flows on geological timescales.
Okay, and the main importance of this then, in terms of advancing our knowledge of, say, plate tectonics and earthquakes, volcanoes, what implications are there?
Well, the deformation of the plates is the missing piece of plate tectonics. This is what we don't understand. And so what we discovered is a new pattern of deformation of the plates, and this is a very clear demonstration that they do in fact flow like fluids at great depth, and this deformation drives what happens at the surface. This is the engine that determines the pattern of distribution of earthquakes in particular.
Okay, so previously they didn't think that that the rock actually became more fluid like. Was that it? Was that the previous thinking?
That's right. In the Aegean and in many other regions, most geologists thought that blocks rather than viscous fluid was the behavior of the lithosphere. Even though, we know that if you heat the rock enough, it will melt and flow, but in practice, deep tectonic plates usually are thought as being more rigid, but in fact it is a viscous fluid that flows very, very slowly, but this is how it behaves nevertheless.
Okay, so what you've done is really you've confirmed the theory of plate tectonics as we understand it, and you've just provided an extra piece of information there. Do you think this knowledge will help us to, I mean, what people in geology always are trying to do is to better predict earthquakes and volcanoes. Would it have any impact on that, on the ability to do that?
Well, this is basic research, and with discoveries in our field, it's hard to predict which one will be most useful for immediate societal needs. But without this kind of research, we would certainly not understand why and how earthquakes happen. So this is very important to understand the basics.
And it's increasing
in order to
try
to forecast earthquakes.
Okay, well, listen, thanks very much for coming on and telling us about that.
It's my pleasure.
We were talking there to Sergei Lebedev of the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies about a new paper in Nature Geoscience where the pieces of the Earth's crust, they now think that actually they can become fluid once they are subjected to high temperatures, which is a new finding. Okay, now, in another new slot this week, 2020 I call it, where we actually look at things that are happening in science that may actually change the world that we live in. One thing that's happening, of course, is this whole area of stem cell research and what's called regenerative medicine. It's moving very, very fast. But this week I noticed there was a report of research that's taking place in Israel, where they've managed to take skin cells, ordinary skin cells, and basically induce them to become heart cells or brain cells. So this is quite amazing, because this opens at least the possibility to solving perhaps some of our organ donation problems into the future. If we can take skin cells, which of course people are willing to donate, and they can be generated into a heart cell or into a brain cell, then maybe at some point in the future we can use somebody's skin cells from their own skin cells and use those to create, say, part of new heart tissue that's been damaged or part of new brain tissue that has been damaged, and then re-implant back into the body. So, I mean, this is a possibility and a way that we might get around the whole embryonic stem cell debate and controversy where scientists are proposing to use or are using embryos to advance stem cell research and stem cell knowledge. So that's an interesting study there this week from Israel. Okay, now moving on to our last guest today in the writer's room, I'm going to be talking to Patrick Wise-Jackson. He's the curator of the the curator of the museum in TCD, and he's written a book, Introducing Paleontology, A Guide to Ancient Life. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Sean. Good afternoon.
How are you? Sorry about the introduction there, but I was just trying to get your name up here on screen.
No problem.
Congratulations on the book anyway. It's a lovely book.
Thank you.
There's very nice illustrations. And first of all, I mean, I presume that this was aimed at a general audience as well as people that are already interested in fossils and do it for a living.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, my intention at the outset was to write a book that was heavily illustrated in colour for the general public, but also for students in various universities taking paleontology and the study of fossils sort of from first principles. So aimed at a number of audiences.
Okay, and there is, of course, sorry, you're the curator of the Geological Museum, I should have said at the outset, at Trinity College. I got tongue-tied there. So some of the fossils anyway that you mention or that are pictured here in this lovely book, they are bait. You can see them in Trinity, can't you?
Yes, you can. What I did is I picked particularly good specimens, beautiful specimens that we have on display in the museum, so that if your listeners or readers wish to come and look at them, they can see them in the flesh, so to speak.
Okay, just tell us about the museum then. If they wanted to go in, any member of the public could go in and visit the museum. How would they find it, or what's the opening hours?
The museum is open here in the middle of Trinity College, in the middle of the campus, in a building called the Museum Building, and when you get in there, the museum is on the top floor, and we're open Monday to Friday from 10 o'clock in the morning till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay.
And it is free, and if groups wish to come in, they can always contact me via the webpage.
Okay. What's your webpage? We might as well give that out.
Well, I can give you my email address.
Yeah, sure.
Which is wysjckn, for Norman, p@tcd.ie.
Okay, right. Now, just moving on to your book. So you've divided it up into sections. And one, you talk about the whole science of paleontology, which is the study of fossils and how it began, etc. So maybe give us a little bit of background. I mean, how long is this science of paleontology around? And, you know, I suppose it developed from the days of amateur collectors into a professional endeavor.
Well, it did. Geology as a subject has been around, say, for 200 years, and paleontology is a distinct branch of that. Now, in sort of medieval times and right up to the 1800s, people believed sort of folklore associated fossils. So certain types were loaves of bread left behind by fairies, or they were thunderbolts from heaven. But by the 1800s, scientists and men of science started to describe these fossils, and they began to understand that they were, in fact, the remains of organic life.
Mm-hmm.
So from 1800 onwards, as the science developed, we got large numbers of descriptions of fossil types. And then probably in the last 50 years or so, paleontologists started looking at them in terms of where they lived in the past, what was the environment like, how did these fossils, how do they operate as living organisms?
Mm-hmm.
What I like doing is not simply considering them as lumps of stone, but what can we tell about the mode of life of the animal that maybe created the skeleton that was subsequently fossilized?
Absolutely. And some of them are just, like, I'm looking at one image here in your book, which is a footprint of a dinosaur, which is amazing looking at it. You can see it very, very clearly, and a real dinosaur left that very clear footprint. So that's fascinating, isn't it? Really triggers the imagination.
Well, it does, and you can take it where you can look at this object and say that is a beautiful object, but you can actually use that object to demonstrate things like how heavy the dinosaur was,
okay.
How fast was it moving across the sediment.
By measuring the distance, say, between the steps, or, you know.
That's right. And for example, if I was to walk along a beach, I would leave a footprint in the sand. If somebody lighter than me walked across the same beach, they'd leave a less of a footprint. So by doing that, you can actually get an estimate of the size of the animal. So it's a more dynamic, and And I like to think of paleontology also not only looking at geology, but really looking at the biology of the past.
Sure. Now, let's be a little bit parochial. I know your book is much broader than that, and it could be read anywhere, literally. You know, it's looking at all specimens from all over the world. But here in Ireland, is there much interest in collecting fossils?
Well, there are a number of places where you can see lovely fossils. That said, there is legislation to protect many parts of our sort of scientific heritage. So I wouldn't actively encourage people to go around with hammers removing large numbers of fossils.
But you do have in your book, you know, if somebody is interested, you kind of give them ways where they can collect and study fossils and do it in the proper way.
That's right. There are places you can go, but although you would need to check with the local authorities, you would need to check with landowners that you are free to go onto the land and look at fossils as well. And I would encourage people, if they do that, simply not to over-collect, you know, and we have people who occasionally will come in with large numbers of fossils where maybe one or two might have been perfectly sufficient for them.
Sure, to be aware that it you know, not to cause damage or... Yeah, to have respect for what they're collecting.
That's right.
And you can also, as well as the creatures like dinosaurs and the very large boned creatures, if you like, you can find the remnants of, you know, very soft creatures such as sponges or various types of worms and things like that. They often, or not often, but they occasionally leave traces behind, don't they?
They do, and this is an area of the science that people have become particularly interested in. If we can understand how animals decay, we may be able to understand how they may have been preserved in the past. And there are some classic localities in British Columbia where we've got some very early fossils from about 500 million years ago, with loads and loads of soft-bodied organisms that were buried rapidly in sediment, and there was no oxygen in the sediment, so they tended not to decay. And the traces are left preserved in a film of, I think it's clay.
Mm-hmm.
And these soft-bodied organisms, you wouldn't normally expect to find them, but they are fascinating because they actually tell us the full range of organisms that lived in the past.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think you can imagine if you go down to the beach at the present day and looked at all the soft-bodied organisms and counted the number of those that had shells, the chances are those with shells may fossilize. Those without shells and are soft won't.
Yes.
So those would ultimately usually disappear. And in the fossil record, you tend to get a biased record with the soft parts, with the hard parts, rather.
Sure, it's like, old wooden buildings. They don't survive very well. It's kind of something similar maybe to that.
That's right. Yes, good analogy there.
Well, listen, sorry I don't have more time to talk to you, but I would recommend this book highly. It looks great, apart from anything else. There's some fabulous colour imagery in it, and it's a good read as well. And it's... The price, $13.85. I got it for. I think it's in Hodges Figgis anyway in Dublin, if anybody wants to buy it, probably in other shops too. So thanks very much for coming on, Patrick.
Thank you, we're delighted.
Okay, that's Patrick Wise-Jackson. He's the curator of the Geology Museum at TCD. He was telling me about his book, Introducing Paleontology, A Guide to Ancient Life. Okay, that's all we have time for this week, folks. We'd just like to draw your attention to our website. It's sciencespin.com. That's the magazine, sciencespin.com. If you'd like to find out more about what's happening generally in science in Ireland, go there and give us your email, sign up with your email, and we'll send out the magazine for free. We'd love to hear from you. And so that's the end of another show, and I'll talk to you again next week. Bye bye for now.